Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello. Hello, and welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode number 108. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following, he rattles his microphone, four genres.
Thrillers.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
And crime.
Well done.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to get that right. Welcome to the show. And we ought to mention who our guest is later on in the programme.
So our guest this week is a lovely lady called Julie Anderson.
Julie Anderson speaks to us from Clapham in South London, which, as we discover, is an amazing hotbed of current and past literary talent, including her own. But she runs Clapham Writers and their festival, which is held on October the 14th, that she will drum into us a little later with some fabulous guests.
Yeah,
so it's nice
amazing
to speak to another festival organiser and reflect on the health of the festival market in the UK.
And the enthusiasm of the festival organisers.
Absolutely. Totally. But let's get into news. And I have to say, this week, it's one I've been waiting to talk about, because in the middle of this week, earlier this week, there was a blog post from an American gentleman who pointed out that there is a clause within the contracts that we've been signing up with Findaway Voices. Now, Findaway Voices, based in Ohio, recently bought out by Spotify, are distributors of audio books. And we have distributed no fewer than 11 Hobeck audio, but actually 12. No, 12.
I was going to say, yeah. It's
12 audiobook productions that we've put through there. And I've also worked for them as a narrator separately. Anyway, within their contracts, which we didn't spot, right at the very back end, is a provision which gives them the permission, allegedly, to use the productions that go through Findaway Voices, farm them off to Apple, who have been developing, as we've mentioned before on the show, AI narration. So essentially, unbeknownst to almost everybody, even though it's in the contract, almost everybody, they have been basically using productions, but more importantly, narrators' voices for AI learning, to teach machine learning how to narrate and put those same people potentially out of jobs. So it has caused a huge ruckus. I'm extremely annoyed by it.
He is.
I am absolutely apoplectic about it, to be perfectly honest. And I wrote to them under the terms of the contract and withdrew permission for all the voices that we have used. That's Robert Dawes, Judy Dakin, E.B. Morgan, and Leanne Walker, and myself, and have demanded that all of our voices are withdrawn from that program.
Yes.
I feel very strongly about this.
Yeah, and you replied, sorry, they replied with just a acknowledgement. It wasn't, there was nothing.
There was nothing by further explanation. It has been sat in that contract for 2 years. Now, you would argue that perhaps we should have looked at it closer. Yeah, we should have done. And, you know, buyer beware and all that sort of thing. We should have looked at it closer. However, it has caught everybody in the indie community off guard. And a lot of narrators are very, very upset about this. And I think that, you know, Findaway's approach is, yeah, okay, they have withdrawn those voices from the program, but who knows what Apple have done with them to this point?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I mean, there's a period of time, isn't there, where we, when we weren't aware, it could already be, I mean, do they, can they take back anything if we now say we don't want to be part of it? Or is it too late for whatever's happened so far?
I imagine it's too late.
Okay.
I imagine it's too late. I mean, I'm not saying that any of the voices necessarily are going to be ones that Apple have been working on. Their principal interest will be getting American voices down. And look, their AI narration is getting good. It's not, I don't think, adequate for character voices for fiction. But for nonfiction, it's a real option. And they will argue that authors and publishing houses need to have a cheaper alternative than using human labour, because it is very labour intensive, as I have been proving for several years, but also in the last couple of weeks, I've been working almost exclusively on audiobooks. Not quite exclusively, but certainly it's been an enormous amount of my time.
Yes, you've come out every now and then to eat and sleep.
Yeah, but not a lot else. And this afternoon, having recorded two chapters of a production I'm working on, two very, very big chapters, I ought to stress, I've been editing all afternoon. So it is very, very labour intensive and therefore pricier than people perhaps wish to pay.
Yeah, I mean, we, from a publisher's perspective, we know that it'll take a lot of sales to recoup what we might pay for a freelance narrator, human being.
Yeah.
So,
you know, you might think, listening to this, well, what's our gripe? You know, could have seen it in the contract. Yes, that's true. Well, my gripe is this: as publishers, we don't have the rights to license the voice prints and voices of narrators. You know, this is my voice, obviously, could have been used, and that's my lookout. But I've got to look out for the interests of people for whom narration, particularly in the case of Leanne Walker, is their income. And this is not okay. This is another sign that increasingly, hidden in the big tech agreements that we sign, you know, just click here and agree to whatever, we assume it's in our best interests. Actually, they're hiding this sort of stuff where they're learning stuff. Now, I find that, you know, given that Findaway have positioned themselves in the market as not Audible, not Amazon, and have tried to present themselves as the honest brokers in the audio market, this is hugely damaging to their reputation, in my view. And in terms of our Hoback relationship with them, we now have to sincerely and severely consider withdrawing working with them, because I'm so angry about it. And we have to find an alternative. There is an alternative platform that has just launched. It's probably not as good, doesn't reach as many places, but there's a principle at the centre of this. And I'd also have to obviously look at the contracts. This is an outfit called Authors Direct, who offer about 40 different platforms, so not dissimilar to the Findaway model to, you know, you can distribute through them.
But I think that's part of the problem, isn't it? When you are dealing with somebody who effectively has a monopoly, they're the only company. I'm not saying, you know, in this case, obviously there is an alternative, but everything else aside, Findaway would be the preferred option for us, because absolutely, it's convenient, yeah. It's easy, it's all in one place.
Absolutely, and it goes into a particular catalogue, which is extremely important in terms of reaching library listeners in the United States. So that's important. Now, look, this is not the only thing that is giving great concern around AI. Another thing that has changed this week is that the government, at one point, were going to allow, this is the UK government, AI companies to be able to buy a book, for instance, feed the text into their systems and encourage their AIs to create something similar.
Mm-hmm.
And this was going to be something that was exempted in UK copyright changes, but they have decided that's a bad idea. It is an extremely bad idea.
Well, that's good news then, isn't it? That's good
to an extent. To an extent. Well, I mean, you know, let's see. So, you know, we've got that perhaps headed off. Another thing that has been a positive piece of news in terms of big tech is Amazon have finally, after a lot of pressure and lobbying, changed their rules about returning books.
Yes, I saw that.
E-books.
As well, yeah.
And I think this is a huge change as well, because quite a number of people, and I'm not sure, this has happened to us a bit, a tiny bit, have had the phenomenon where people are basically using it as a free lending library, because what they do is they will get the book on Kindle, pay their $2.99 or whatever it is, or whatever fee is being charged for that Kindle book, read it, and then return it within the statutory allowed time, which was 7 days, and get a refund. But the refund was then passed on to the publisher and authors.
Yeah, so we do see that. We see minus $2.99 in our data.
It does happen.
It does happen, yeah.
Now, what Amazon have decided to do and announced this week, after a lot of pressure from both sides of the Atlantic, is that if a book is read to a certain degree, something like 10%, then you will no longer be eligible for a refund.
Fair enough.
So, at last, a shift in that regard. But there are other things that are afoot with Amazon that we're going to talk about as we investigate, but rumours circulating about authors getting dropped by Amazon just arbitrarily.
This is extremely worrying, isn't it?
I mean, you know, look, we you know, anyone who's dealt with KDP and the whole system will have a litany of issues and problems that they've had in the past. We've had loads, and we've talked about it on the podcast. You know, we put productions up, and then they challenge our right to publish them, and it can be weeks before we get a book out, weeks after the publication date.
Yeah, which has happened.
So, yeah, and that's just one thing. And, you know, they've often, you know, they threaten people with, well, they do it to people. They actually just cancel their accounts because of some infringement, and then you're banned from the shop front.
Yeah, and if that happened to us, it would be crucifying.
Well, it would be fatal.
Yes, okay, fatal. Crucifying is fatal.
Well, yeah, but that's perhaps a little past the thing. You know, it would be the end of Hoback as it stands. It'd be very hard to withstand that problem. So I won't say too much at this point, but we want to do some more research into that. Let's have what's the issue that you wanted to bring to listeners' attention?
This isn't happy news either, really, but I have been working as a freelancer doing mainly editorial but also publishing project management work for how old is my oldest child? He's 19. So 19 years I've been doing this, and I haven't seen much of a pay rise in that time. In fact, one of the companies I work for, I'm not going to name any names, I've been working for them for 17 years. I've only had my fee increased once, and that was about 15 years ago. And it's partly because I'm too scared to ask, because they could just turn around and say, okay, we don't need you anymore. And it would hurt me more than it would hurt them. So there's a new report from the Literature Alliance in Scotland. So this is specifically looking at Scotland, obviously, but I think it applies globally, about the fact that freelance editors are not earning enough money. So full-time freelance editors are earning around £21,000 in 2022. That's terrible. You can't live on £21,000, can you?
Not really, no.
An average hourly rate of £10.90, which is... given that it's a skill that you have to learn or you have to train for, that's not very good.
No, it's dreadful. I mean, look, it was a similar situation in the broadcast game. You know, you get this impression that broadcasters earn loads and loads of money, but the freelancers, I have to say, the rates of pay had been frozen for the entire decade that I was in charge of my department, because, I mean, the freelance rates weren't set by me.
Mm.
And there were colleagues in London on the BBC World Service with years and years and years of experience earning £110 a day. So, you know, for an 8-9 hour shift, just above minimum wage.
Yeah.
And now, and of course, you know, 10, 15 years ago, before that, it wasn't massively generous necessarily, but it was enough. But now it's dreadful, and it's indescribable, some of the rates of pay that local radio pay people who go and watch football matches, that didn't get their petrol.
You're doing it for love, that sort
well,
of thing.
It, like all of the creative industries, it tends to exploit for love, unless you're at the very top. So yeah, this is something that needs to shift without question.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting increasingly difficult to make ends meet on doing the same amount of hours, or I do more hours and get the same amount of value from the money I earn. And it's tough.
Yeah, it is. It really is. Well, we don't want to moan constantly and too much, but, you know, let's be perfectly honest. The creative industries are under enormous pressure. But let's think positively. We have to try. I think that, I mean, I was approached by Wired magazine, one of the leading, well, probably the leading magazine that reflects tech trends.
Yes.
In the world. And I offered them some quotes. I'm not sure if they've done the story yet about Find a Way. But they did ask me one pertinent question, which was, you know, in a world where AI is moving in on so many areas of creative world, mm-hmm. including audiobooks, how do you differentiate and how do you, you know, continue to make an impact in that market? And I said, I think that the future is that you're going to have two different models. In the way that when audiobooks were first created, because they were on cassette, mm-hmm. people used to do abridged versions and unabridged versions.
So what's the difference between bridged and unabridged?
Well, unabridged is the full text of the book.
Okay.
Abridged was a shortened version, which you get on Radio 4 if you're listening to a book at bedtime. It's you know, take an 8 hour eight hours of novel,
yeah,
80,000 words, and only put out 5 episodes of even 15 minutes.
Yes.
In a week. That's abridged. And of course, you know, to keep costs down, and if you wanted a version which gave you the meat of the story, but, you know, on 2 cassettes, that's what they used to do. So that was a point of difference. Now I think the point of difference is going to be abridged, unabridged, and then AI versus human narration.
Well, I think, like we were talking about when ebooks first came out and everybody said, that's it, it's the death of paperbacks and hardbacks and whatever. It wasn't. People still want authenticity. They still want the human touch. They still want imagination.
Mm.
There will be a market for it. Absolutely, no doubt about that. But it's not going to be the death of people as creators.
No, I don't think it is. But, I mean, you know, people, they will argue that this gives you another option. But if you've listened to AI stuff on YouTube, a lot of people use AI because, excuse me, they're creating videos in countries where English is not their first language. And so what they do is they will put in a script, they'll write something, get it Google translated, and then shove it out. And when anything technical comes in, acronyms, yeah, or whatever, they will just muller them.
It's quite humorous, isn't it?
Sometimes? It is. And look, I've been doing, as I say, some narration for these for the books of Gordon Doherty, Roman Legion books, and they are extremely demanding in terms of your knowledge of pronunciations, in terms of Latin. They're also full of emotion, where people speak in broken sentences because they've got a spear in their chest, or, you know, they're coughing up blood, just about to die, and they've got their final words to say.
You would speak in broken sentences,
well,
in that case.
I can't believe that AI operation is going to be subtle enough to deal with that.
Not at the moment, though.
Unless it's got a lot of human input to point out the points where it needs to do something different. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
You know, straightforward text in, you know, parentheses or whatever, in inverted commas, and speech, yeah, it can deal with that. But when it's got something, you know, where someone's stuttering or all sorts of elements, the emotion is very hard to deliver. And I find that as a performer. What it's going to be like for a computer to figure it out, I don't know. But maybe I'm being naive. And let's just go back to over that point again. I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's right that companies should be putting in their contracts that they have, you know, given that we've used some contractors to do the narration, to have their voices given up to that big system that's trying to replace them without their knowledge. And that is disgraceful. And indeed, any opportunity, because it has to come through us as publishers to get it, that permission withdrawn. The narrators have no say on it.
No, I mean, it was just that one of our narrators pointed it out. I wasn't aware of this at all. So
it is, yeah, it's a squall and a storm that's brewing, and I've had my say on it. And again, you know, we will look at it again. Let's get to our interview. and speak to Julie Anderson, who joined us from Clapham, as I say. It's an amazing part of South London. It was up and coming when I was first living in London, in many ways, and it was just about affordable for the better off of my colleagues at the BBC. Now it's way beyond that, but it is a great literary setting, and Julie's very proud of her connection to it. She's a former civil servant, senior civil servant, now retired, but writing her own political thrillers, particularly, but also very heavily involved in the Clapham Literary Festival. And it sounds like a great event. So let's talk to Julie Anderson. Well, it's delightful to be joined by Julie Anderson from your home in South London.
That's right, in Clapham. Clapham. Thank you for inviting me. It should be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. And it's Clapham that we're going to focus on because, of course, you're heavily involved in Clapham Writers and the festival there.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. I'm chair of trustees of the charitable organisation that runs the annual book festival, celebrating books and reading in South London.
Yeah, brilliant.
So how long's that been going then?
We started in 2016. Essentially, a group of us got together. There are a lot of writers who live in Clapham, which is strange, but there you go. And people who are in publishing generally. And we just got together and thought, wouldn't it be fun, given that, you know, there are all of us lot here and we know lots of other writers, if we set up a book festival. So we did. And there was definitely something of the let's put on a show about it, if you know what I mean. But we did. And we joined with the local theatre and a local independent bookshop and the library. And that was the first Clapham Book Festival in 2016. And we've been going ever since, apart from 2020, of course, when nothing happened. We're now set up formally. We're a charity, and we have a bank account, and we have a profile. Indeed, we've just been nominated, and I've got this written down. Remember to mention the award. we've just been nominated for the food and culture awards for 2023 for South London, and we're in the innovative arts category. Why innovative? I'm not sure. but so is the Wimbledon Book Fest and the Polka Theatre and, you know, lots of others. I guess it's because we've had to adapt given COVID, and we've done some interesting things. We don't just do individual author events now, in-person events. We also do literary walks and online and so on. So we're a bit of a mixture now. But anyway, we're all getting together to do this on the 14th of October this year. So I shall say that date several times during the talk.
What are we doing on the 14th of October? We might be able to come down,
well,
you know.
Oh, come, we know where come. We are. We're going to be in Clapham.
Yes, oh, no, that would be super to see you. Do come.
Well, we'd love to. We'd love to. And Clapham is such a fabulous artistic community, as you've already mentioned. I know a lot of people. It was the go-to place when I was working at the BBC, and we were all setting up families and homes. Yes. In the this is the mid-90s, probably the early 2000s. And a lot of my contemporaries went for Clapham and Balham as their, you know, it was the affordable but very nice place to live.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I've been here for more years than I care to remember, certainly before the period you just described. But yeah, I mean, it's lovely. It's Victorian, so it's leafy, but you've got the Georgian old town and you've got the common, which is lovely. And lots of people from publishing live around here, and lots of people from the BBC, actually. We had, who do we have? We had Kate Ady.
Yep.
And Frank Gardner. Although he doesn't live around here now. Ed Stoughton is one of our interviewers. He comes along regularly and helps us out. We've had quite a few BBC guys, because there are quite a lot of them living around here.
Absolutely. And Ed Stoughton's just had his memoir out, and it's ruffled a few feathers because when he got fired from the Today programme, the way that it was done and handled, very BBC. This is the way, you know, your career ends in
a sea of platitudes and suggestions that, you know, this is an exciting opportunity for you, losing your main gig and income. You know, there's plenty of opportunities for you out there. Eventually, he fought his way into keeping a show on Radio 4. But, yeah, we've all been there, those of us who've left the BBC.
Oh, absolutely. And we had Ed on. When did he come? I think it was 2019 or maybe 21, he came and talked about his book about the BBC, you know, Auntie during wartime, which was fascinating, with a chap called Simon Burtham, who used to live here. I don't know whether you know him. He was BBC at one point, though he was also commercial television. He did World in Action for many years.
Ah, right, yeah.
World in Action.
He was actually, Ed was very interesting talking about what's happened to the BBC. I mean, like you say, it's very BBC the way that he was his services were dispensed with. But I mean, he was asked all sorts of questions about reporting and bias and so on. Specifically, I mean, yeah, Clapham is, you know, Clapham is almost the People's Republic of Clapham, really.
Yes.
So we were the borough that had, I think, the second highest vote after Gibraltar for staying in the European Union.
Really? Yeah. That's a great statistic.
And so there were lots of questions for Ed about, you know, the BBC reporting on Brexit and the prioritisation of balance over truth and all that sort of thing. Which was a terrifically interesting session, but we're very Radio 4, I'm afraid. I mean, and therefore the festival tends to be quite Radio 4 as well.
Absolutely,
I'm quite Radio 4, so I'd like that.
You are. Well, we both are. We both are. I mean, I used to work for Five Live, but anyway, the common station. No, it's interesting. I mean, I just had a flick through your previous speakers, and two friends of our program, the Hobcast Book Show, have been on your in fact, I think more than that, but certainly the ones who stand out for me are Vaseem Khan
and Abhir
Mukherjee, who are two great friends of the program and the best fun ever.
Absolutely.
To spend time with. But in terms of, have you got your program, is it taking shape now for the 14th of October? See, it's etched on my soul now.
Well done. No, unfortunately, I would love to be able to preview our programme, but our programme director has sworn me to secrecy because she hasn't actually got people signing on the dotted line yet. So I can't actually mention it. But we are talking to some very interesting names. Some of whom have a filmic profile. A film level profile.
Oh, that's a clue.
Yeah. But I can't, I'm afraid that's it. I mean, it's a horrible tease because I would be marmalised by Paula if I mentioned any of these names.
Yeah, but that's a great way to do it, isn't it? Because that gets everyone quite excited because we don't know.
No, we don't know. I mean, we've had some very, very good people on in the past. I mean, last year we had our headliner was Sir Anthony Beaver, who, of course, wasn't doing interviews at that stage because, of course, he'd been very ill. But talking about his latest book on Russia, which was fascinating. And just having someone there who had this incredible comprehensive knowledge of essentially 20th century European history. We're asking him because he's written that wonderful book about Civil War Spain as well. Yeah. And there were questions from all over the audience about all that too. And he just has this amazing amount of knowledge.
He does. His books are incredible. I've read Stalingrad,
yes,
which was the one that came out in around 1999, I think. Mm-hmm. It's the level of research that, especially at that time when he could get into the Russian archives. Yeah. So he was exposing all sorts of new documents that hadn't been translated into English. Yeah. And I think equally the same sort of access went into his Berlin book, which followed, because obviously the, you know, East German archives were opened up as well. Mm-hmm. And it gave him access to all sorts of facts and figures and just the incredible, in amongst all that detail, the narrative that he's able to weave as well and take you along is extraordinary. He's a great, great writer. One of the greats, I think, in terms of, I think he's up there with A.G.P. Taylor, to be honest.
Well, yeah. No, I remember reading him for A-level, so.
Yeah, didn't we all?
Yeah, I mean, he was terrific at the festival. He is terrific, and it is that sort of wealth of background research, I think. That, and I mean, he was quite amusing about being banned in Russia, and banned in various other places, more liberal places actually. He was banned in Spain for a while.
Wow. And,
Because he explained, because of a mistranslation in his Spanish Civil War book,
right,
which essentially turned the meaning completely opposite to that which he had intended. But that has been put right now, so he is no longer banned in Spain. He was for a time, but he's still banned in Russia. Something he seems quite proud of, I have to say.
Well, I think probably being banned by this version of Russia is a badge of honour.
Absolutely. But he was just terrific. We sold the theatre out. We could have filled two theatres with people to come and see him. He was pretty tremendous. But Abir came that same day. Actually, I interviewed him for the crime time slot. We always do a crime slot. And he came, and he's a joy to interview because you don't have to do anything. I mean, it's like you point him at the audience and off he goes.
Yeah.
He was hugely, hugely entertaining and absolutely fabulous. I really enjoy his Wyndham and Banerjee books. I think they're super. But I also like Vaz's Persis Wadia, for the Malabar House series that he's writing. I saw him recently. He was at the Crime Writers Association Christmas party before Christmas. But
yes, he's on the board now, I think.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
And a cover reveal for that next book came out, I think, a week ago or so.
I saw it. Wow. I haven't seen that.
Yeah. I got very excited. Oh, they're great covers. So yeah. The two of them are just brilliant. They're great podcasts.
The podcast is fab, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Red Hot Chili Writers. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a plug for them. We'll keep them happy. when we next bump into them at Crime Fest or wherever it might be. So, indeed, balancing that with, I guess you're describing a festival that started off with that burst of enthusiasm that often does with a great idea like this. But then the cold reality of, as you say, 2020, not being able to hold the event. It's one of those things where I've looked at, even the bookseller, every week we see a festival saying that this year we can't afford to run it, X, Y, Z, part of the country. So, has there been a point during that the lockdown and such like where the future of the festival was ever in jeopardy?
I don't think we actually thought about it, to be honest. I think it was interesting when we got to sort of January, February 21, and we were thinking, well, are we going to have it this year? We didn't have it last year. And the sort of management team was divided, to be absolutely honest. Because it was a punt, even though it would happen in the autumn, we weren't entirely sure that, one would be allowed to have book festivals and, in theatres and so on. And it was a punt. And we decided that we would go for it, but we would diversify somewhat. So we would have some live in-person events, not too many. We went for two big names. We went for Sir Michael Morpurgo, which was hugely successful. And actually, it was Ed that year. Ed came and did his session in the evening. And then we had some online events around the sort of showcase in-person events and also some walks, because Clapham has a lot of writers living here now, but in the past has had even more. I mean, I did some research for it and found it is astonishing. I mean, did you know that the Times newspaper started in Clapham?
I didn't know that.
Well, it did. Come to Clapham Book Fest on the 14th of October. I'm doing the walk again, so come on the walk.
I love that. Yeah, I love that sort of thing.
I like the idea of the walks because I haven't heard of that anywhere else doing a literary walk. What does that involve?
Well, it involves me tramping around Clapham Common with a group of people. But actually, it's more difficult deciding which writers to leave out than it is to find material. There is so much. There is just so much. And we restrict it, or my version of the walk is around the common. But the writer Anne Marie Neary, have you come across her? She's an Irish writer. She also lives in Clapham. And she focused very much on Clapham North Side and the area between Clapham North Side and the Wandsworth Road, because you have the, an amazing concentration of wonderful writers. So you have Angela Carter living, who lived down there, lived in Clapham for many, many years. I've just forgotten his name, a very famous Japanese writer. But Angela Carter ran a salon, which I didn't know about until Anne-Marie and I did some research for this in the London Library. She would help young aspiring writers around her kitchen table. And these included, and wait for the names, J.G. Ballard, Salman Rushdie, Kazuo Ishiguro.
These
people, I mean, all of them have, and Rushdie in particular, have actually gone public with his thanks and gratitude to Carter for all the help she gave him when he was up and coming. Likewise, Ishiguro. So we can actually claim a Nobel laureate.
You can.
As well as the probably the most famous writer of fiction who was never nominated for a Nobel, of course, which is Graham Greene, who lived overlooking Clapham Common.
Amazing.
And yeah. And set his novel, The End of the Affair, on Clapham Common.
I think I'd be too scared to sit in a cafe in Clapham, because you're going to end up as a character in someone's book. Yeah. Because it'll be full of writers.
Well, the awful thing is, it's true. I mean, the full of writers bit, if not the, you know, characters in someone's book. But yeah, there are a lot of us around.
That's staggering. I mean, I used to get very excited when I was I used to be a tour guide. Between the ages
you can give me some
18
tips.
And 25. Sorry?
You can give me some tips.
Oh, well, I think you put it down.
Tips, because he makes the stories up.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, you know, there's nothing so good as a made-up Cambridge University story.
That gets in the history book.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, okay. Oh. Well, I think, you know, listeners probably, you know, it's about 50 episodes ago when I first mentioned this, so I will tell you what the story is. One of the stops that we used to have is a very sort of prosaic stop. On our bus. This was an open-top bus going around Cambridge, and you could hop on and off as you wished. A company called Guide Friday. They're no longer with us, unfortunately. But the principle was that you can get on and off, and people get on at the bus station at Drummer Street, which is, it's okay. It's got Emmanuel College on one side. And when we parked up, we could see over into the grounds of Emmanuel College. Very high wall, but you could see over. And there were these gigantic ducks waddling around. Now, on my very first day as a guide, we were stuck there. There was a bit of traffic and we couldn't get going. So I made up a story, and somebody asked me, "Hey, those ducks, they're enormous," you know, sort of some Texan bloke or something. And I go, "Yes, that's because each of them, when you become a fellow of Emmanuel College, you are presented with your own personal duck." And fellows pay the ground staff to make sure that their duck is particularly well looked after. And so they become the fattest ducks at Cambridge University. And there are 44 of them to match the number of fellows that are currently are within the college. I made this figure up. Sadly, of course, when a fellow passes on, the duck goes with them.
And they are served at
they are served at the memorial dinner. Stood upon by the master and the senior fellows. So that story is now in a history book in Cambridge as official fact, and that just came springing out of my head.
Wonderful.
That's in a book.
It is absolutely. But I mean, it's just the idea of the ducks. I mean, that's what's the most absurd, that these ducks waddling around.
Yeah.
Imagine that they had sort of little gold name tags on.
That's the sort of thing, yeah. They wear, you know, subfusc or whatever they do, you know, in Cambridge, the equivalent on feast days. It just so happened they had a pond there, and, you know, they were just ducks, just random ducks.
A wonderful story. It really is.
Thank you. No, I mean, the trick to it, when I was going around on my Cambridge tour, was that there were a number of literary points within that tour, clearly, because so many great writers. So you would go past in Silver Street, you would look up, and there's a tower on the corner of Queen's College, just by the river. Mm-hmm. And there's a tiny little window at the top. And it was the room that Erasmus had at Queen's College. Wow. So there you are, one of the great humanists. Then you would drive around, and then occasionally, and I've told this story many times on the podcast, Stephen Hawking would roll into view.
Yeah.
And at that stage, he was the best-selling non-fiction writer in the history of the world in the mid-80s,
yeah,
with The Brief History of Time. It was still number one when I was still doing my tour 3 years later. And there he was. You know, so you would have all these opportunities to talk about great literary figures.
You sold him pants once, didn't you?
I did sell him some underpants, yeah.
In Marks and Spencer's, they sold Stephen Hawking some pants.
That's like one of those things, you know, you go on quiz shows on TV,
yeah,
and Victoria Corrin says, and here's Adrian, whose claim to fame is selling Stephen Hawking some underpants in Marks,
yeah,
and
that's right, and Clive James as well, so another great literary figure, or having an argument with Jermaine Greer over printer ribbons. These things happen. So, you know, the literary thing, it's a great hook, and it is always amazing when you mention someone that people have heard of in terms of their writing, and they just sort of go,
they just, it's that place though, isn't it? It's that sense of place.
Yeah.
You think that person, yeah, lived there, walked down that street, and, you know,
I kind of have this vision of Clapham being surrounded by blue plaques on every other door.
I don't know whether it's every other door, but there are quite a lot of them. It's interesting you mentioned sort of sense of place, because the very first Clapham Book Fest in 2016, we did a session with Elizabeth Buchan, the novelist who lives just around the corner from me, actually, and Professor Simon Beaumont, who was, the Beaumonts are a very old Clapham family, but he's now living out in Ealing, and he just bought out a wonderful book called Night Walking. I don't know whether you've come across it, about walking around London after dark, but going back to sort of medieval times and even earlier, up to the present day. I mean, he's friends with that sort of group of flaneurs that include Will Self and you know, the others. He and I chaired the discussion, and it was actually very interesting, talking about Clapham as a sort of focus for writers, really, and why somewhere like Clapham should attract quite so many of them. Now, to an extent, I mean, it's economic, like you described. You know, if you lived in the BBC and you want a nice leafy area that's affordable, when you buy your flat or you know, your first house, you look south of the river and there's Clapham with its common and so on. But that wasn't, I guess, that couldn't be the only reason, because Clapham through the ages has attracted writers. I mean, the earliest I could find it, we had a Clapham writer on the Mayflower that sailed to America, and he became the second governor of Virginia, I believe. And he wrote Home Thoughts from Abroad, and they were published in London. But he's the earliest one I could find. But I mean, that's long before Clapham was even part of London, you know. And yeah, then you go through, age, yeah, you know, the sort of the heyday of Clapham, which is the late 17th, early 18th century. And you get Samuel Pepys coming to live here to escape the bad London air. And in fact, there's still, it's interesting because the house where he stayed has long gone. He is recognised in a number of ways, and most recently by another writer, John Lanchester, who lives in Clapham, who you may have read Capital.
Yes.
His book Capital, which of course is set in Pepys Road, as a nod to a predecessor there. And so you get all that life of books begetting books and being self-referential and so on. But it does go back, writers settling here goes back a long time, and long before it was the escape, the affordable escape from the city. So what was it about Clapham that attracted them? And we had a long discussion, and actually came up, our answer was the common, actually.
Yes, I was going to say, this must be the common, yeah.
Because it's that sort of liminal space where, you know, you have, the mind becomes free as well as the body, as it were, and allows you to escape from the confines. And it was a terrifically interesting discussion. We ought to repeat it at some point, I guess. But that was the very first Book Fest.
That's amazing. Mm. I have to say, Peeps used to figure on my tour, dare I say, because he went to Magdalen College in Kent. And on Bridge Street, if you ever visit, ladies and gentlemen, opposite the college is a fabulous timber-framed building. It's about three stories. And there are carvings. So at eye level, when you're on an open-top bus, are carvings, very lewd carvings of...
Oh, lewd ones.
Yes. Oh. Yes, because it was a brothel, as frequented by Samuel Pepys. It's now part of the college. But these lewd carvings are ladies with their assets on view and gentlemen holding their...
I think we get the picture.
Anyway, I used to glory in telling this story, as you can imagine, because those on the top deck, it was always a bit of titillation, you know, Samuel Pepys and a bit of this, that and the other. And then one day I didn't realise, but 20 Carmelite nuns had got on board downstairs and I hadn't seen them get on board. And I'm telling this story about a bordello. It didn't go down too well.
The nuns weren't pleased.
No, they were not happy. The stony faces when I came downstairs. There you go.
But actually, that's interesting. That's not my experience of sort of cloistered clergy, as it were. They always seem really up for a laugh, I have to say.
Yeah. They either didn't understand me or they understood me too well. But I sometimes so you'd have them rolling in the aisles.
Yes.
The punters. And it would be wonderful. And other times you would tread somewhere that they didn't want to go. And they take umbrage, but that's just the way I used to do things. So don't take my leave from my tour guiding thing, pushing the boundaries. In terms of your own writing career, let's turn to that now, Julie, because we really ought to. Political thrillers. What's the attraction to writing them for you?
I was a senior civil servant in Whitehall for many years. And when I was persuaded that I ought to write crime, I started out writing historical fiction and set in 13th century Spain, which was a niche market. And as you can imagine, did not sell that well. But I was then persuaded to try my hand at crime and contemporary crime. And where would I set it? Well, the obvious place to set it is the world I know very well, which is the world of Whitehall and Westminster. And I wrote the first Cassandra Fortune book back in 2018, entitled Plague, and it was published in 2020.
Timing.
It's not a pandemic book at all, but it does astonishingly. The villain is selling off public contracts to cronies.
So, wow.
When the PPE scandal.
Yeah.
Lady Moan raises her head again on our podcast.
Yeah, he likes talking about her.
Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, I think that it should be talked about an awful lot, quite frankly. Yes. I think you can't talk about it too much because these people essentially have swindled the taxpayer, as far as I can see. Mm. But anyway, that was an element, as was a demonstration down Whitehall. I mean, in my book, you have these sort of anti-science campaigners, for which read anti-vax campaigners.
Yeah, how strange!
And it was it that all seemed to be incredibly prescient. And then I sort of took her off to Greece for the second one, and then the third one is came out last September called Opera.
Yeah.
Which is focused back in the world of Westminster and Whitehall again, which is a sort of espionage novel, I guess. And that's doing quite well. It's been quite well received. So,
yeah, oh, good.
I'm quite pleased about that. And that is the trilogy. So I'm writing something a bit different now. I'm writing something. I decided I wanted to. Well, the genesis of it anyway was I wanted to write about the pandemic without writing about the pandemic. And I don't write speculative fiction. So I looked, as is a sort of knee-jerk reaction for me, to the past. And it seemed to me that there were lots of correspondences with the world immediately post-World War II, with a sort of bankrupt and austere Britain after a global conflagrationing, which many people had died. So my new book, which is going to be the first in another series, probably a trilogy. Why do I write books in threes? I don't know. is set in 1946 in Clapham. In a real place, which is opposite Clapham South Underground station. The building is still there, which was the South London Hospital for Women and Children, which was a remarkable place. It was set up in 1913 by two women surgeons who had trained in, and indeed one had worked in, the new hospital in North London, which became the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, a hospital run by and for women. And essentially frustrated by the lack of opportunities open to them. And in response to a huge demand for women, from women, to be treated by women, because the Elizabeth Garrett Anderson was always oversubscribed, they decided to set up their own hospital in South London. And these two ladies, suffragists and feminists, did it. They raised the money with their friends, and they bought two buildings on the south side of Clapham Common and set up the South London. And that was in existence there until it was closed by Wandsworth Health Authority in 1986 as part of a general reorganisation. And it was much loved by the people who worked there and the people who were treated there, and became a sort of cause célèbre for the women's movement, because the building was occupied for 2 years. With many of the nurses who had worked there continuing to offer nursing in the buildings there. And we had, this was just before my time in Clapham, but there were Greenham Common women there and people from all over the globe. Women's groups came to try and force the government to hold it open. There were questions in Parliament and so on. But eventually it was closed. And this is a tangent. Have you seen a film called Green for Danger?
No.
Do, if you like mystery stories. It's a black and white film set during World War II in Britain with Alistair Sim as the police inspector. And Trevor Howard as one of the doctors. It was based on a book by Christiana Brand, which is regarded as one of the classic locked room mysteries. It's a little gem of a film that I've always admired, and I wanted that in my book, that sort of a setting. And there was, you know, the buildings, which is now, it's a Tesco on the ground floor and apartments above, but you know, there was the building of the South London Hospital just down the road from me, and so, you know, hey ho, that's the genesis of my latest, which is in manuscript form at the moment.
Excellent. That's exciting.
That does sound exciting. That sounds...
I also love when you base it...
dramatisation.
Yeah, when it's based in reality enough that, you know, the people can refer to where it was set and they can see where it was set. And so place and history.
Well, places I've realised incredibly important to me as a writer. I mean, if you read the Cassie Fortune novels, especially the two set in London, although actually the other one set in Greece is set in a real place too, you will find all sorts of places you can go and visit. I did a plague walk when plague came out during 2020. Of course, we couldn't do anything inside. And a lot of the publicity that had been planned, of course, was shelved because, you know, you couldn't get groups of people together. But one of the things that did occur to me to do was to do a walk. It was just for publicity purposes, you know, with a photographer, walking the course of the old River Tyburn just north of Oxford Street, down through Westminster to Thorny Island. And oddly enough, I'm talking to the Thorny Island Society tomorrow night. The Thorny Island Society and Friends of St James's Park at 6:30. So if anyone, actually, this will go out after I've done that.
It will.
I can't puff it. It's these places are real that appear in it, and indeed a lot of the hidden places too. People don't know about, especially under Whitehall, which I did know about because of my time there as a civil servant, and especially a civil servant who liked history. And so, you know, catnip for me, really.
Absolutely. No, they have featured those passages that lead down from Admiralty Arch have been featured in one of our books.
Have they? Which one?
Yeah, the Angel of Whitehall.
Yeah.
Ah. Ironically.
Right.
Yeah. By Lewis Hastings. And a lot of the drama and action under those wartime passages through Admiralty Arch into the bunker, that Admiralty building, and that big concrete monstrosity that backs onto the Horse Guards Parade, that kind of area. It is astonishing, and I have good friends who are in the civil service still, and I just love hearing about what's down there because they've got a similar historical bent. So yeah, it's brilliant. That sounds great. I think about Tyburn, that you mentioned it, the River Tyburn, but Tyburn itself,
yeah,
the famous place where the majority of public executions were done. I find it that it's now Marble Arch. People call it Speaker's Corner. I find it incredibly. There's an aura around that little section on the top of Oxford Street, next to Park Lane. It's just, I don't know, it's still got that feeling of the terror and the horror of the things that happened there, I think. Don't know if that's the case.
Well, the famous triple tree. It's interesting. Mark Gatiss wrote a short story, which was turned into a ghost story on BBC, I think, which included... it was set in a house which had been an old house with, the sort of wainscot paneling. And the wood was taken from one of the triple trees at Tyburn. And that then had, all sorts of spooky ramifications.
I'm sure it did.
Within the house. But that was all about... That sort of atmosphere that you're talking about. I actually say the atmosphere I get around Hyde Park Corner is fumes. I mean, really bad atmosphere. But it is an odd sort of place, that sort of little island of nothing really.
It is. And then once you go into Hyde Park, then there's a different feel, but you have to walk for about 5 minutes to get rid of the traffic, and then suddenly the silence starts to descend, and then it's the sound of people enjoying themselves and it takes over, which is extraordinary.
Have you read there's Neil Stevenson's Baroque trilogy, and the third one is called it'll come to me, but it's it actually features the hero of the book being taken to Tyburn for his execution on the back of, the upturned cart that they used to have to sit in, and along that recognised procession. And they have recognised stops where, the priest comes out and tries to save your soul and so on and so forth. And he's taken along that procession route to Tyburn, where he's hung. There's a riot, and because the College of Physicians want his body, and of course lots of ordinary people are again dissection after death and so on. So he survives, but it's called The System of the World. That's right. There were three in the Baroque trilogy: The Confusion, The System of the World, and another one which I can't remember the name of. But they're terrific reads. They're great fun. And there is this set piece at the end of book three where Jack is taken to Tyburn to be hung. It's very, very interesting.
Oh, must get to that. Must get to that. And in terms of running Clapham Writers, how much does that support your writing in terms of having that community of creatives that you're so attached to?
Well, a lot, really. You asked me earlier about whether the book festival might have died because of COVID. And I think one of the reasons that it didn't, and we never even thought that it would, was that the people who organise this actually really like each other. we enjoy each other's company. We enjoy talking about books. We enjoy going out for meals. We enjoy all the stuff around organising a book festival. And that was, I think, one of the reasons why we never even questioned that it might stop, because we were enjoying ourselves too much.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, we don't have any subsidy, and we have very little sponsorship. We just have some local businesses that sponsor it. So it has to pay for itself. So it's and this is a very bonding experience when it gets to 2 weeks before the best showcase day happens and you haven't sold enough tickets to cover the costs. And we all get incredibly stressed and, you know, go on about more publicity and et cetera, et cetera. And getting it into the Royal Society of Literature magazine or tweets or whatever, get it out there. And then, of course, the day actually happens and it's fine. There's no problem. Yeah. But there's an amazing bonding experience there. and so, you know, it's terrific. And I also, I mean, a lot of those people are writers, and some of them are great friends. And so it's rather wonderful having, you know, we can go for a walk around the common, and two or three people can sound off about, you know, the publishing industry and their agents and whatever. And also, you know, if one gets stuck, it's good to be able to talk to someone. And they're all, and because I was a civil servant for so long, I mean, the people around here have been writing for their entire careers. I mean, Lizzie's published sort of 18 novels, and wow, there are others like that. So it's just tremendous being able to tap into that sort of knowledge and experience, really, as a relatively new writer. You know, it's great.
Terrific. Well, on
I
that
want
positive
to move.
Note, yeah, no, too right, yeah.
There's not many in Stafford.
No, there aren't. But anyway,
is that where you are, Stafford?
Staffordshire, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Staffordshire. Well, Staffordshire's lovely, and you've got, I mean, that's Dr. Johnson, isn't it? Is it Dr. Johnson?
I think so. And
we got the fisherman. What's his name?
Isaac Walton.
Isaac Walton. Yeah.
And Dave Gorman, of course.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful part of the world. I love the countryside.
It is. It just needs some decent cafes and some writers working in them.
Nice cafes.
No. Anyway, let us get to the moment that everyone dreads, including the listeners. No. They love this bit. Okay. It's time for the random question. I will do the proper introduction now. Rebecca's random question.
So I don't know if you've got any pets or not, but it's related to pets. Recently, I came across this cat called the palace cat. Now, a palace cat lives in very cold climates and is a big, fluffy thing with teeth. It's a cat, though. And I thought I'd love to have one of those. So my question is, what's the most unusual animal you'd like to have as a pet?
Ooh, now. Well, I've had cats all my life. We don't have any at the moment, because when we retired, we decided, just before COVID, my husband retired just before COVID, that we would like to travel. So when our last cat died, we didn't replace her, but we've always had a house full of cats. And so my obvious answer to that would be something like a big cat, you know. It's like when you're 10, you go and watch Born Free at the cinema, you know, and
yes,
you want a lion for the rest of your life, basically. So I suppose my first reaction to that question would be I'd like a big cat of some kind, but I guess that's not that unusual. If you're looking for something more interesting, my niece keeps lizards.
That's quite interesting.
And Komodo, she's got a Komodo dragon.
No, that is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, my godson and his new wife were given a Komodo dragon as one of their wedding presents. It was a surprise from some of his mates. He's a doctor. So, you know, yeah. And so when they got to the bridal chamber in the evening, because they held the wedding in this beautiful 17th century country house. When they got to the bridal chamber in the evening, there was a very large cage with a Komodo dragon in it. At which point, Andrea hit the roof. But anyway, that sort of, I haven't really answered your question, but I hope I've given you some good stories.
That's an amazing story.
There is actually a domestic cat. I can't remember its name, but it kind of looks like a leopard. But it's do you remember?
Yes, you showed me some pictures. So it was the
with a African,
some sort of weird name, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1B or something. Yeah.
Yeah, something like one. Yeah, it's got 1B on the end of its name, and it's a real cat, and it's domestic cat, but it's massive. It can climb onto. It could just lean on the kitchen surface. It's so big. Yeah. But it's like having a big cat without the danger.
Oh well, I'll have one of those then, please. Whatever they're called.
I can't remember.
Yeah, we're going to have to, that stretches now. Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't have any ambitions other than we've got Aki, our cat.
My brother once had a stick insect as a pet.
Yeah.
Not very cuddly, but.
No. But then neither are lizards. I can't understand. Yeah, my niece is called Rebecca, and I can't quite understand what she sees in the lizards. But every time I go and visit, I have to go in and look at the vivarium, is it? I'm not sure.
Yes, a vivarium. Yeah, that's right.
Vivarium, and say hello, because she gives them names as well. So I have to say hello to these, these lizards, and she goes and gets things like worms and feeds them.
Oh, I wouldn't like that bit.
Well, I've been reading a book or listening to it, actually, about Maxwell Knight, who possibly are familiar with because he was the head of MI5 and is the inspiration behind M.
Let me guess, he kept stick insects.
No, he kept all sorts. And actually, I think he also lived in Clapham at one point. Certainly, he had a flat in Tooting, which had a bear in it at one stage.
What else would you put in your flat in Tooting?
Exactly.
You
know? This bear eventually had to go. He had a menagerie of animals at all points in his life. It was his great passion. And he had the most extraordinary range of animals at one point, but he had a bear. Domestic.
Well, we all have bears. We have teddy bears, don't we? I guess.
Yeah, we like bears, but
he had a considerably sized bear. I think it's actually when he was living in St. James's anyway. But this book is peppered. This incredible guy who rose up through the ranks in the 1920s, became the definitive spy master, and yet had this extraordinary love of keeping weird pets and loads of them. And his poor, long-suffering wife had to put up with all this. Yeah, extraordinary.
You can also imagine, I mean, St. James's is just so classically the park, isn't it, for spies? Mm.
Yes.
And you know, when you have, in the old sort of black and white movies, you have the two men sitting, because they're always men, sitting on a park bench.
On a park bench, yeah.
Ducks, and passing surreptitiously documents to each other or that, which of course, you know, somebody like Philby actually did.
Yeah.
I now imagine spy masters not just sort of going out there and feeding the ducks, but taking their bear for a walk.
Yeah, taking the bear for a walk, yeah.
St. James's Park.
To eat the ducks.
To eat the ducks belonging to the fellows of Emmanuel College, Cambridge.
That's right.
Even. I think we have a story there.
We have.
Fantastic. Well, Julie, it's been an absolute pleasure. Let's remind people then, on October the 14th this year.
Clapham Book Festival.
Clapham Book Festival. Organised by Clapham Writers. Now, I noticed that if people want to know more about Clapham Writers and actually donate to you, there is a way of doing so.
We have a website. We are www.claphambookfestival.com. And the charity has its own too, which is www.claphamwriters.com. If you would like to donate money to us, we are run entirely by volunteers, and it takes quite a lot of work to do, but it's huge fun. And I hope I'll see you two there next time.
I'd like to.
We would. It's in the diary now.
Let's
so
look at the, yeah.
Absolutely. Julie, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
The passion for Clapham and everything.
The
literary
passion for Clapham. Do you know, I was actually in London yesterday. I went there for the day.
You went south of the river as well.
I did?
Yeah, you went to Waterloo.
Oh, is that south of the river?
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, so I met 4 university friends for lunch at a place called Tass in Waterloo. and very near the Old Vic. So that took me by surprise as well, because I was walking along the street and there was the Old Vic.
Which, of course, featured very heavily in a recent episode.
Yes, exactly that.
And we talked to Anne Coates.
So I thought of Anne Coates, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could say to my friends, let's go to Clapham, but they wanted to go to Camden Market instead. So near, but yet not quite near enough.
Yeah, okay. Well, we will do it. We're often, our holes not so long away. We could go through Clapham. Well, it would be a pain if we did, and we'd have to pay the congestion charge, or whatever they call it now, ULEZ or whatever it is, if we did do so. But, yeah, we'll go to Clapham before long.
Good.
Absolutely. This week we also went to see our Uncle Bob.
We did.
Mr. Robert Dawes on stage in a fabulous one-man show called Woodhouse in Wonderland. P.G. Woodhouse reflecting on his life in his Long Island recreation of his study. And Robert is brilliant in it. He was born to play that part, really.
He was fantastic, wasn't he? It just flowed. He was funny, he was witty, everything. It was
sang a lot.
He did sing a lot. And
very well.
I've forgotten the name of the musical now.
Anything goes.
Anything goes. Yeah. And then we took him to the pub and we had a pint.
We did. It was terrific. And our fabulous cover designer, Chain Matt, was also there with her husband, Ian. So just brilliant evening. And, Bob obviously has a massive passion for it. I highly recommend it. It's going to a lot of theatres around the country in the UK, and it's going to go to the States. And apparently it's going to India as well. So plenty of opportunities to catch it in Mumbai at some point in the not too distant future. Highly recommended. He's currently playing in Windsor as we record this. It's a tour de force, and brilliantly written by William Humble as well, who's a great writer. So, highly recommended. And we're not just saying that because it's our Uncle Bob.
No, it was brilliant. At all. Yeah, it was really, really good.
Yeah. So that was terrific. In terms of what awaits us this week, we've got a week until half term.
We do. So, yes, last week of full-on work. Our submissions, as we record this, are closing tonight. But by the time this podcast goes out, you're too late.
Yeah, we've had a lot, as you'd expect. We rarely open the submissions window because it's just we get swamped. And obviously we're looking forward to reading them and getting some fabulous potential authors for Hoback Books. But we're going to use that half-term break. We're in Sussex for the week. We will continue to do the podcast, of course. During that period, we will be reading submissions, and it will mean I'm not near my studio, which I've got cabin fever at the moment because I'm putting so many hours in there every day to.
You might
to
get withdrawal symptoms.
Meet my commitments. No. I mean, it is a very enclosed world, and when I'm in the zone. When the words are flowing freely and I'm not stumbling or whatever, it's actually a real pleasure to do it. But for me to get to that point, sometimes last night would be a good example. So it was about 10 to 8 at night and I was doing my third chapter of the day and it was over an hour long. By this point, I'd gone past the hour mark on the actual recording. And what I ought to say is that I'm editing as I go. So I go over the bits that I've made a mistake and pick it up where... it's called punch and roll is the technique. It's very, very useful for doing this thing a lot quicker than I did in the past. But I could have wept because there was one sentence. I took 10 run-ups at it and I can't remember what the word was. I just could not say it at all. I tried doing it separately and then editing it back in. That didn't work.
Oh, I wonder what the word was.
Oh.
You'll have to let us know.
Well, I always have, there's always going to be something.
No,
it wasn't that I didn't know how to say it. It's just that I couldn't get my tongue through it. I just couldn't say all the consonants in the order that they came clearly enough to get it landing.
Blimey.
And I just could weep because I knew the kids were hungry. I knew I had to go to the chippy to go and get us dinner. And, I could hear them sort of stumbling around, sort of pacing around, waiting for someone
like
to...
Like tigers.
Because it's an hour later than normal. and you're in London on the train back, and it was soul destroying. It really was.
Well, you poor thing.
Yeah.
And next week, we've also got Valentine's Day, haven't we? So.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to get showered with love and petals.
Yes. Yes, you are.
I was in M&S Garage today, and even though it's 2 days till Valentine's Day as we record this, there were three men came in and bought flowers and chocolates from an M&S Garage.
Well, that's for their mothers, as they go and visit them in their home.
It's very
whatever.
Cute, though. I thought it was quite cute.
Yeah. Well observed. Well, look, thank you so much for joining us. We ought to mention who is our guest next week.
It's a lady called Abigail Osborne, who is published with Bloodhound Books.
Fabulous. And writes psychological thrillers.
Yes. Yeah, so we're looking forward to talking to her about her experience as a writer and a published author.
Fabulous. Well, we'll look forward to that. And, we wish you, obviously, a great week. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you. Don't forget to go to our website at www.hobeck.net for details of all of our books. We got any coming out this week?
We have. I was just about to say, we haven't mentioned Bad Blood by R.D. Nixon is publishing tomorrow as this goes out. So
how can we forget that? Let's talk about that.
So it's Terry Nixon, who writes crime fiction as R.D. Nixon. She's written lots of things as Terry Nixon. She writes fantasy and Cornish saga, historical saga books. But for us, she writes crime fiction. It's the third book in her series, the Clifford McKenzie series, set in the Highlands of Scotland. And I love them all, and I particularly love this song because it's about the art world. It's called Bad Blood. It's coming out on Tuesday.
Fabulous. Well, look, what a way to end it. Bad Blood, R.D. Nixon. Look out for it. Look out for the email from the Hobeck newsletter. Don't forget to sign up to that. You get free books from it. Well, you get a free a compendium of fabulous writing from our writers from that. And, of course, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast from wherever you get your podcasts from. We'd be delighted if you did so. But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Have a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.